Music was my first love, and it will be my last. Music of the future and music of the past. So said John Miles in 1975. This is the Guardian Music Podcast. I'm Alexis Petridis, and my first love was a girl called Caroline Newhouse, who dumped me after a week because she said she was moving towards Jesus and I wasn't. On this week's show, we've got divisive indie quartet The Wild Beasts, we've got Radiohead, Lightning Dust, and death metal disco scene in Singles Club. Alex Needham recalls the far out and gone world of 80s transvestite singer slash actor slash actress Divine in Feature with No Name. But first, the Stone Roses. One of the greatest aspects of the modern music industry is its ability to rescue lost classics from the undeserved obscurity into which they have fallen. Such is the case with a little-known Mancunian band of the late 80s called the Stone Roses. They recorded their debut album in 1989, but its blend of Birds-influenced jangles, swaggering attitude and impossibly funky drumming sadly failed to resonate with the British public, despite sounding very much like the kind of record that people would spend the next 20 years going on and on and on about. Little has been heard of the Stone Roses since its release, but now the album is back, giving the nation a rare chance to enjoy little-heard songs like Fool's Gold and She Bangs the Drums. It comes in a deluxe edition, complete with extra tracks, demos, and a video about the making of the album. This will hopefully let the world in on the secret of how producer John Leckie transformed vocalist Ian Brown, a man who, let's face facts, honks like a despondent goose, into the silver-throated singer audible on the album. With me in the studio today, as ever, Rosie Swash. Hello, Rosie, how are you?
I'm very good, how are you?
I'm not too bad, thank you. You got on the phone to bassist Manny, I believe.
I did. It was good for me. You talk about this lost classic. I was 7 when the album came out.
Wow.
So obviously,
so was I.
I have no recollection whatsoever about it being made. Manny, hopefully, thankfully, did have a few. I asked him what it was like when the album first came out, and was he anxious?
Even before we recorded the album, and we were working tirelessly on the songs on a daily basis, you know, and we knew the songs had great potential, and we knew they were going to make it, you know, and it was just a question of when we found John Leckie and got in and got him recorded, we knew it was going to have an impact. We just had that much supreme self-belief. What we've done, you know, and bordering on arrogance, you know, a lot of people think we were arrogant, but it was just 100% knowledge of knowing that we had, that no one else had songs like these, and we'd done a good, you know, we were over happy with, kind of happy with how they turned out in the studio, and we would, it was just like, you know, you've got the winning lottery ticket in your hand, but you're not allowed to cash it in just yet, kind of, you know.
So you couldn't wait to, you couldn't
no,
wait to
we
get
couldn't
out
wait,
there.
You know, and we just wanted to get out and bring it to the world, and when it eventually did come out. It was a bit of a slow burner, you know, at first. You know, the press were a bit slow to pick up on it, and it was a slow burner. It's not like it immediately just went bang and hit the number one spot or anything. So, yeah, but we knew what we had, and we just couldn't wait out and take it to the world.
How did you know the rest of the band? Just because I know that John and Ian went to school together.
Yeah.
How did you meet them?
I met them in the late 70s, early 80s, via the medium of scootering.
Scooter? What, like mods?
Yeah, we're all like kind of Lambretta boys and scooter boys and stuff. And we used to go to this club called Pips in Manchester. And that's where a friend of mine, Kaiser, who was a singer in a band that myself and John Squire had, called The Waterfront, he introduced me to him in the Northern Soul Room at Pips, this club in Manchester, and he was kind of different, you know, that's what I liked about him. He wasn't a total psycho like most of my mates. He was a bit of a thinker and very artistic and really great sense of style about him, you know, and I thought, this kid's different, and I like him, you know.
I know that the band kind of changed a bit by the time that the Stone Roses came out, but individually, what were the influences that each of you had? I mean, I know that a lot has been written about how important house music was to you at that point?
No, it's just the fact that particularly myself and Ian Brown were going out clubbing when we probably should have been working, you know. Because we've always had a great love of rhythmic music, you know, whether it be like Northern Soul or 70s funk. And Acid House was just another progression along that. And we just loved going out and having a boogie and checking chicks out and stuff, you know, the usual thing that young boys do.
What was the best bit for you? Was it the very early days, or was it Spike Island?
Do you know, the very early days of just and going around playing gigs to, like, not a lot of people and just honing our acts and time spent in this little lock-up studio that we used to go in every day, you know. A lot of people seem to think, bang, success materialises instantaneously on a silver plate. It doesn't. We work bloody hard for it. And that's where a lot of other bands have failed.
There has been a lot in the press ever since you guys split up to suggest that there's bad feeling between the individual members. Is that true? Is it been...
Well, do you know what? I'm godfather to three of John Squire's kids. I still see him regular. I speak to Ian every week. I haven't seen so much of Rennie, but from my angle, there's no bad feeling. I love all the guys with a passion, you know. John and Ian had a fallout, but it's nothing that can't be put right. They're grown men, and they should kiss and make up, really. It's a shame that the legacy is kind of tainted in a way. But I think when John walked, I think Ian felt betrayed. It's, you know, it's a songwriting partnership. It goes a lot deeper than just mere friendship, you know. It's a creative force. And I think John had to do it because we were dysfunctional by that time. And he's a very driven guy, you know. Without people like John Squire in the band, we never achieved anything that we did because the guy was so focused. Where, you know, when me and Ian had been going out enjoying ourselves, John was never one for the limelight, and he's always happier when he's creating. You know, he's a great artist in that way.
I mean, the rumours about you guys reuniting just won't go away, and they keep popping there.
Well, do you know what it is? It's because that record, or those records, made such an effect on people's lives, least of all our own. People really want us to do it again. Personally speaking, I don't like the way it all finished. It's sad, you know. It would have been nice to close the book, you know, with the final chapter and close it properly. But then again, you can't cry over spilt milk. We had a great time. It's done. It's dusted. We're all doing well individually. I'm having a whale of a time in Primal Scream. If it happens, it happens, but I'm not going to waste no sleep over it anymore.
What is the one memory of your time with the Stone Roses when you think back to it that really stands out for you, good or bad? What's the sort of image you have in your mind when you remember being in that band?
Oh, you know, just having the biggest belly laughs with the guys, you know, it was insane, absolutely insane. And we used to spend more time just rolling around the floor, fucking wetting ourselves, laughing at stuff and, you know, impressions that people were doing to people or... Honestly, the humour was amazing. I absolutely loved it. The creativity was great, the music. Just being with the guys and just having an absolute nobble was brilliant, man. The worst part of it was just when it finished, that was my dream, and it was just snatched away, and it still hurts, you know?
Oh, I wanted to end on a good note, and then you said that, and it made me feel sad.
Well, yeah, it does still hurt, but like such is life.
But overall, your memories are fond ones.
Brilliant, yeah. Honestly, do you know what? I got to travel the world. And some little scumbag from North Manchester gets to travel the world, living beyond his wildest dreams. All he's had to do is learn how to play a guitar and meet up with some good guys, like-minded souls, and just create. And it's amazing. And do you know what? If we could do it, anybody can do it. Oh. Kids out there today should use their heads and follow their dreams because they're attainable.
Oh, that seems a perfect place to end it. Thank you very much for speaking to me, Manny.
I was in a belter, babe. Thank you.
The 20th anniversary Bonanza bumper package version of the Stone Roses album is out on Monday, August the 10th. And now it's time for Singles Club. Joining us in the studio today to discuss three hot new releases is Tim Jones.
Hello, Alexis.
How you doing?
I am absolutely great.
What's been going on in your world then?
I've just moved house.
Have you?
I've just moved house to London's fashionable Dalston.
London's fashionable Dalston. Yes. Marvellous. How's that? How's that treating you?
It's good. It's fashionable.
Excellent. Do you feel more fashionable for going, for moving that?
Well, I look it. I mean, obviously.
Obviously you look it, but I mean, for the benefit of people who can't see you.
Well, I sound it.
Yes, you do sound it. Yes, absolutely. Anyway, Singles Club. Tim's choice first, I think we're going to go with, which is Radiohead. Now, of course, we all know who Radiohead are. The band returned unexpectedly this week with a charity single in honour of the last soldier to have survived the trenches of World War One, who, as we all know, died last week. But after giving away their last album, In Rainbows, the band have abandoned their free policy and are now charging a whole pound for this single. All proceeds go to the Royal British Legion, and this is In Memory of Harry Patch. Smile, a song, a funny little dance. Radiohead there, In Memory of Harry Patch. Tim, you chose that.
I did. I think what I like about it is it kind of, you know, it shows how songs can be tied with the story they're about. I think it's a very moving kind of string part in itself. But, you know, obviously the fact that you know it's written about Harry Patch, who just died, and you've read the obituaries and you've been moved by the story, and then you hear this music, it's hard not to feel quite kind of move when you hear it.
Yeah.
So I heard it straight after it had aired on Radio 4 at 9 a.m. and I do often feel like crying at 9 a.m. when I'm in the office anyway. So maybe that was more to do with it. But I suppose the song itself sounds like Sigur Rós quite a bit.
It does a bit. Yeah. It also sounds, I thought the backing sounded a bit like Discreet Music by Brian Eno.
Okay.
I had a touch of that about it.
I like the fact that it's a song.
Yeah.
And I don't like Radiohead when they're not writing songs.
Mm. I think it's really interesting insofar as it's, this is what the internet is for. This is what this model of, you know, putting music out on the internet should be about. You've made a reactive record. Mm-hmm. You've got it out there. You're selling it to the public within a few days of this event actually happening. It's a long time since music's been able to do that. You used to do that a lot in the 60s if you look at records like For What It's Worth by the Buffalo Springfield, which I think was out and in the charts, you know, a couple of weeks after the Sunset Strip riot happened, which is what it's about, or Ohio by Crosby, Stills, Nash & Young, another record that came out very quickly. And we seem to have lost the ability to do that because of lead-in times and campaign, you know, huge promotional campaigns. And I think what's brilliant about this, other than the fact that despite I was sort of taking the mickey out of it for being miserable, it is a beautiful, beautiful record. You know, well done Radiohead for doing that.
Especially as at the moment people are talking about political records and they seem to be mentioning Reverend and the Makers.
Absolutely, yeah. There's definitely that sense at the moment that if you go, we are being political,
yeah,
you get a round of applause regardless of what you're actually saying.
Well, exactly.
You know.
War is bad.
War is definitely
let's
bad.
Let's
BNP.
Tackle the BNP, yeah. Oh.
Like that Gallows record. We're all going to hell. The wolves are howling. Anyway, Rosie, what did you make?
Well, I have written down in my notes that, yet again, you realise that a band who've been around for, what, 15 plus years now are pretty much alone in tackling anything like this.
Yeah.
It is good. It is fantastic, actually, to hear somebody reacting to an event that has the capacity to move a, you know, large part of the nation. But I have to be honest with you, I don't think it's something that I'm going to listen to again or a lot.
Mm, I could see. It's a bit of a downer.
Out when you DJ. that was part of my set in Dalston tonight.
You know, I don't know if it was you that said it or someone said it to me earlier. Tom York sounds like he's dying.
Yeah, it does sound like an old guy dying.
And that's good, but it's not pleasant. I mean, it's a good record, for what it is standing alone. But it's also quite unpleasant, and that's the point of it, I suppose.
Yeah,
that's what makes it poignant.
You do kind of get reminded quite often of how Radiohead, appears to be operating on a slightly different level to everybody else, you know, as a band. And whatever criticisms you want to make of them, and whatever, you know, however sort of abstruse their paths and things like that might appear, you can't knock them for continually trying to do something different and something new. And, you know, full marks to Radiohead, I think, for doing that. That is available for £1. All proceeds go to the Royal British Legion on the band's website, radiohead.com. Now, next up, Rosie's choice, Lightning Dust. That's Lightning Dust with I Knew. Lightning Dust are a two-piece from Vancouver, Canada, comprising of Joshua Wells and Amber. Are they the same Joshua Wells and Amber from Vancouver's stoner rock outfit, Black Mountain, I hear you ask? The answer is yes. They're also a couple in real life, released their second album, Infinite Light, this week. I Knew is the first single to be taken from it. Rosie.
Yes, this is my choice.
I thought that was Boss.
It's brilliant. It's, I have to say, not really like the rest of their stuff. I was very surprised when I heard it.
What's the rest of their stuff like?
It's all sort of like her vibratos, you know, it's like stretching it. I love it, but stretching out this like vibrato, Grace Thick kind of voice, and he plays the Hammond organ, and it's all a bit sitting on the porch, shooting trespassers, mulling over life. In a good way, obviously, of course. As if anyone didn't realise.
Yeah.
And so I was very excited to get their new record, put this on, and it just wasn't what I was expecting at all. At the beginning, they've got this kind of tapping noise which sets the rhythm, which is like a needle on the record player just bashing but faster than it normally would. I love the energy of it. I love the way she turns those vocals around when she sings the chorus, and the kind of propulsiveness, I hate that word, is almost entirely driven by, I don't even think there are drums in this. There might be drums.
It doesn't, I was going to ask you, it doesn't at a later point in the song sort of explode.
No, that's what's good about, that's what I like about it as well, is it keeps momentum because it doesn't at any point burst open. So I just think it sounds fantastic, even if it isn't like the rest of their stuff.
I really liked it. Her voice also reminded me a little bit of Mark Bolan in the Tyrannosaurus Rex days. That's kind of bleaty lamb thing. Obviously, you being too young to remember the Stone Roses will have no idea what I'm talking about. Well, a bit before my time, Grandad. Tim, what did you think of it?
Well, I liked it as well. I thought it was a great pop song. Did anyone else not get a bit annoyed with the treatment on her vocals? I found that slightly annoying that they tried to make that. They gave it a weird electronic effect.
Did they auto-tune her vocals?
I just felt like she got a great voice. But I mean, maybe it's her vibrato skills that you were talking about. But it seemed to... They did a kind of almost Of Montreal thing and made it a little bit tinny and gimmicky when she's obviously got an amazing voice with a lot of kind of feeling to it.
That track again, I Knew, by Lightning Dust, available free from their website, lightningdust.com, which is good if all their other stuff, as Rosie seems to be implying, is rubbish. finally... You were being polite, but there was this little thing.
I love Lightning Dust. I love their first album.
Killed their career. First it was Ray Gunn, now it's...
Oh, I know. Oh, it's just now it's Lightning Poor Dust. Old Ray Gunn. Finally, my choice this week. This is 21 by Death Metal Disco Scene. Then came the war. Then came the clowns. Who sent the pawns to take down town? Death Metal Disco Scene are an as-yet unsigned duo with a vocalist called Scorch Shepherd. They've remixed Bat for Lashes, Lily Allen and Kylie Minogue and describe their sound as dirty crossover pop with an electronic flavour. That was their first single, 21, which is available for free now from their MySpace page. I I hadn't heard that. It's been knocking around on the blogs for a while. I only heard that this morning. Somebody sent me a link to it via Twitter, and I thought that's really good. And all the remixes they've done are really good. The remix of Daniel by Bat for Lashes, I can wholeheartedly recommend as well. It's the second record like that I've really loved this year. There's another single that came out by a band called Parallels, Ultralight by Parallels, who were, I think it's one of Crystal Castles or something like that, sort of side project. And that again had this sort of like unabashed kind of early Madonna 80s electro pop flavour to it, and yet seemed like much less of a pastiche of that kind of music, a slavish pastiche of that music, than say LaRue does. I just thought it was really good. I thought that was a really, really cheered me up this morning. Feel free to disagree with me, Tim Jones.
I'm afraid I might have to disagree. I also came across it on Twitter, and I think it was another Guardian critic.
I believe it was Dorian Lynskey.
Dorian Lynskey, and he described the band as sort of melting his heart, and I find it very hard to imagine how that could melt your heart. I mean, one thing, it doesn't. I find it really quite soulless. It doesn't really touch my heart.
Okay.
And I don't know. I just found it a little bit gimmicky, and also you mentioned, because I'm a big fan of 80s pop, mm-hmm. so that's all good to me, but I just think compared to bands like Crystal Castles and that, it just sounded a bit tacky and nasty. But, you know. Okay.
Well, you're wrong. Rosie.
I don't like it either.
Well, you're wrong too. Thank you very much. Anyway, that was Singles Club. No, go on. Speak your brains, Rosie.
I just, again, we're sort of not taking the piss, but the idea that...
Why, have me?
No, not... Behind my back. I said, Dorian Lynskey saying it melted his heart.
Taking the piss out of Dorian, my best friend. Yeah. The guy was best man at my wedding.
Dorian Lynskey's got a huge heart. So how does it need to be melted, is what we were saying.
That's very true.
It kind of reminded me of something that maybe... It reminded me of Alphabeat or something like that, you know. I know, you know, that real... It just felt like they'd thrown everything they could into a pot in the hope that it would be a hit. And, it really annoyed me. I'm sorry, I couldn't
it's
see...
It's quite all right. No, it's fine.
I think it's the start where they introduce each... It sounds a bit like a really bad version of My Sharona with...
I didn't come here to be insulted. But yeah, I can see the sort of My Sharona influence. And anyway, you're both wrong. That's Death Metal Disco Scene. It's available for free now from the MySpace page, a track called 21.
And here are some other singles out this week. I've been trying to make an attempt to vent, but I just can't admit or come to grips with the fact that I may be done with rap. I need a new outlet. Eminem, Beautiful. Swallow, but I just can't sit back and wallow in my own sorrow. But I know one fact, I'll be one tough fact to follow. Girls Can't Catch, Keep Your Head Up. Madness, Sugar and Spice. Ray Guns, Just Because. You bleed, you always come around. Remember that time we looked so good. We knew we could do it and we knew we should. So that's Singles Club for this week. Thank you very much to Tim Jones coming in with your cockamamie opinions about my choices. Thank you very much for coming in.
Thanks.
Lovely to see you.
Pleasure.
Next up on the show, Wild Beasts, or to give them their technical title, Wild Beasts! They've divided opinion, not least in this studio, with their falsetto vocals and their alliterative lyrics and their loony fan base, one of whom objected to my review of their album, which I gave 3 out of 5. 3 out of 5?
Yeah.
Perfectly reasonable review. And expressed the opinion on Twitter that I was, and I quote, a wazzock. Rosie.
I'm sorry about that, Alexis. I just got a bit carried away.
Yeah, was it you? Yeah, I bet it was you. Yeah. You're
a couple of glasses of wine.
Yeah, late night tweeting. Yeah, wazzock. You went to meet them.
And I like them.
You like them. Yeah, and you like them as a band
yeah,
as well.
Yeah, I love this album. Good. I told you last week that it was nearing to be my favourite album of the year and you couldn't believe it.
No, I can't believe it.
I don't think I'm ever going to recover from that.
Joyless record.
But I got Hayden and Tom into the studio who share vocals.
Did they say I was a wazzer?
No, they didn't talk about you. We didn't talk about you.
Are you sure?
About the review.
You're positive you didn't talk a little bit about my review, my hilarious review.
No, maybe after the interview. But they've just emerged from a cocoon-like studio in Norfolk where they were recording this album. So I wanted to know from them when they came in whether they were looking forward to getting back on the festival circuit or whether they had emerged blinking into the sun.
When we first took those songs out, they were straight from the studio. So they weren't exactly embryonic because obviously we'd finished the album, but we've almost learned how to play them differently. We've kind of forgotten how we did them, and we've had to kind of work out where we are now with them. So, that was the same with the songs from the first album, that they changed a lot over time. So now we play them completely differently, like different tempos, different sounds, and that sort of thing. Apart and dancing on impossible, impossible. I feel as if I've been where you have been. I feel as if I've been where you have been.
What was the reaction like to the new stuff when you first started playing?
It was great. I mean, I think, you know, we toured for a good amount of last year, and I think we wanted the songs to have a bit more energy, and we wanted those sort of songs in our canon. So, you know, we went out on tour the week after we finished recording, so we had all the songs there, and the energy was great, you know, and we were sort of quite exhausted in a way, but having people's reactions sort of fills the well back up, and it was really nice.
I think in fairness as well, we were people had to kind of trust us, I think, to buy the first album, so we I think it was nice that, because I mean, all my favorite artists, I want to go and see what they're doing as of this moment, you know what I mean, not like them touring an album they did 20 years ago. So I think it was nice that people would kind of come along with us.
I think also the sort of music we make, we ask people to meet us in the middle. You know, they're the sort of bands we love, my favourite bands, you know. I'd say people like Leonard Cohen or The Smiths, they're people who you have to meet halfway and you have to let them in. And then there's so much there, but they're not going to give it to you in bite-sized amounts. And I suppose that was how our first album worked, in that if people were willing to meet us halfway, there was so much there. So for the second album, I think once they were already there with us and knew how we worked and how to understand us, then it was, you know, it was almost like the dessert after the mains.
There are the sides of how pop has gone that's a bit kind of gross at the moment. Is this album you've seen where it should be at?
I mean,
whilst trying to be modest, I guess, in your answer.
Well, yeah, of course, this is our vision of pop, basically. Yeah, I mean, I think in a way, pop should be a Trojan horse. It should have the facade of something which is quite welcoming, and you want to let it in, and it's, you know, it's got melody and it's got you know, nice sounds, but as well, there should be a hell of a lot in the belly that when you listen to it 10, 15 times, you should work something else out, and then suddenly it's clicked, there's something else in there, you know, and that's our vision of pop, I think.
And I think kind of pop music is like one person talking to another in a way that they can understand as well, in a lot of ways. I mean, obviously it's become about money. I mean, that is the bottom line, but I mean, the same as folk music, it's like it's a sense of it doesn't have to be an intellectual pursuit, you know what I mean? It can be just, I'm here and I'm talking to you.
I remember reading, I had to ask you about this, a while ago. It was about the time of the first album, and there was some article in The Guardian, I might add, about Kendall being the sort of new place for, you know, the place to, the hotspot for new music. Is that what it felt like to grow up there, or was that a surprise for you to read?
It felt a long, long way from where we needed to be, to, you know, be musicians. A hell of a long way.
There wasn't a vibrant scene when you were growing up.
There was people to listen to you. People were fascinated that young guys should have the nerve to say we want to be in a band. We were taken seriously straight away because you've got to be pretty mad to tell people we're going to be in a band and we're going to, you know, do this as a job. It just doesn't compute. So in that sense, we took ourselves seriously quite early on. And in another sense, people didn't know what to expect. So we wanted to wrong foot them as well, you know. And then when we'd go and play in like a working men's club or down in an old blues bar down an alley or something, we wanted to do something different to, you know, the AC/DC cover bands that were going through it day after day. So
our friends at Kendall, I think it would be fairly laughable that I'm sat inside the Guardian office right now talking about a record I've made, you know what I mean? It's,
right,
it's absolutely, okay. it's like you say, it's I think vibrant is an exaggeration.
Okay. How much do you take on board any criticism that you get? Because this album has had complete polar opposites of reactions. It has a lot of people saying how much they like it, but how affected are you by people that just don't get it, or you just sort of have to roll with it?
It's important to take risks, and it's important to almost make mistakes in a way, and it's rare that people are allowed to do that in modern music, and that's a real shame, you know. I mean, it's rare that an album like Limbo Panto was made, and it's even rarer that a band who made Limbo Panto could make a second album, you know. And that's surely that's what young bands are supposed to do, is to take risks and to make the old guys look old, to push them out of the way and say, look, we're sick of this sort of predictable, safe music, and we're going to, you know, confront you here and make you choose. You know, if you want to really, really please someone, you're going to have to annoy someone.
Wild Beasts there, Two Dancers. Their second album is out on Domino this week. And finally on today's show, the feature with no name. This week, Alex Needham recalls the career of the late, great, and definitely not straight, Divine. There aren't enough transvestite singers, I think, around these days. And Divine lit up the 80s, having begun his career in John Walters films, with a succession of banging high-energy tunes in the early 80s, including You Think You're a Man. Anyway, Alex Needham is a huge fan. He recalls him today in the feature with no name.
I first encountered the work of Divine watching Top of the Pops in 1984 when I was 10 years old. The memory is still vivid, or perhaps lurid would be a better word. Early 80s pop had seen an invasion of what were at the time called gender benders, like Boy George and Annie Lennox. Divine, however, was something else. A former hairdresser called Glenn Milstead, his female alter ego was a jaw-dropping sight, all 20-odd stone gyrating in a silk slip, exploding fright wig and inch-long false eyelashes. Then there was the makeup. Never mind a trowel, this looked like it had been applied with a JCB. The song, called You Think You're a Man, was about as subtle. One of the first productions by Stock Aitken and Waterman, who went on to dominate pop in the 80s, with the somewhat tamer likes of Kylie and Jason. It was full throttle, high energy disco. It turned out that Divine's performance was causing consternation all over the country. I remember the pop columnist in the Yorkshire Evening Post asking how the BBC could ban Frankie Goes to Hollywood's Relax, which had happened a few months earlier, when they let an apparition like Divine on at 7 p.m. on a Sunday. Divine had inspired extreme reactions all his life. Born in Baltimore in 1945, he met the filmmaker John Waters at high school. By the mid-60s, the crossdresser and the director were collaborating on increasingly outrageous films, The Peak, or Trough, depending on your point of view, coming at the finale of 1972's Pink Flamingos, where Divine scoops a freshly laid dog turd off the pavement and eats it, in an unsurprisingly successful bid to be regarded as the world's filthiest person. It was only a matter of time before someone with that much notoriety made a record, and Divine's first single arrived around 10 years later. Called Native Love, Step by Step, it was masterminded by Bobby Orlando, who produced a succession of landmark underground dance records, including the original version of the Pet Shop Boys' West End Girls. Divine's singing talent could best be described as minimal, but his raucous holler is certainly compelling, and the rap in the verses is witty. Lines like Tiffany and Cartier are telling me the time are parodies of bling culture almost 20 years before it took over hip-hop. Native Love wasn't a one-off either. Love Reaction, the follow-up, combined Divine's scarily libidinous vocals with large chunks of New Order's just-released Blue Monday to create a record that hits like a car crash. Fortunately for Divine and Bobby O, New Order were too cool to sue. I also like I'm So Beautiful, which is a strident affirmation of Divine's own fabulousness, and his in-your-face version of the Four Seasons' Walk Like a Man. Although You Think You're a Man and Walk Like a Man got into the British charts, Divine was essentially a cult hero. He was just on the brink of mainstream success when he died in 1989. Hairspray, which he starred in, had stunned the world by being a John Waters film for all the family, and of course now it lives on as a massively successful stage musical on both sides of the Atlantic. Divine was about to take a role in the US TV show Married with Children, when he died in his sleep due to complications rising from an enlarged heart. His records fell out of fashion during the 90s, but they started being played again at the beginning of this decade, when Electroclash revived the concept of rough-edged electronic disco created by outlandish nightclub personalities. DJ Hell remixed Native Love, although to my taste he actually toned it down. And too many DJs also used Divine's records in several of their As Heard on Radio Soul Wax mixes. The Vaselines, one of Kurt Cobain's favourite groups, covered You Think You're a Man, and Michael Stipe is a fan too. Divine didn't make many records, and some of them weren't all that great, but the best are as exciting as pop music gets. He lives on in their grooves, still leering, winking, and loud and proud as ever.
Alex Needham there, recalling the majesty of the 80s artiste Divine. That's about it for this week, but just before we go, Rosie, over to you.
Yes, I'd like to tell everybody that they can subscribe to us on iTunes if they haven't already, if they're listening to it on guardian.co.uk/music. And you can go to Facebook and search for Music Weekly and become our friend. And you can go to blogs.guardian.co.uk/music and you can find where we are there, and you can leave comments and let us know about all the singles this week and the guests.
Yeah, let us know what you thought of the singles, particularly My Choice, Death Metal Disco C. But yeah, that's about it for this week. Thank you very much to the lovely Rosie Swash. Thank you to Tim Jones for coming in. We'll be back in a week's time. Thank you for listening. Bye-bye.